Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Can we grow turnips on Mars? Is our galaxy flatter than a credit card? And does the Milky Way really smell of rum and raspberries? This episode, I got to speak to astrophysicist Dr. Gillian Scudder about some of the strangest facts in the universe.
I'm Dr. Gillian Scudder. I'm an associate professor of physics and astronomy. I just got promoted at Oberlin College in Ohio. But I have lived all over before landing in Ohio. So I grew up in Florida. I did my PhD work in Canada. I did a postdoc in the UK, in Brighton, and now I'm here in the Midwest. So it's been a trip.
Cool. Well, yeah, thanks for joining me on the podcast, Gillian.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, it's great to speak to you. And our paths have crossed, really, because, shortly after this podcast comes out, your latest book is going to be coming out, which is The Milky Way Smells of Rum and Raspberries.
Yes.
And I suppose it's like a compendium of strange facts about space and the universe.
Yep.
Would it be fair to say that your entry point into strange facts about the universe came about as a result of the Astroquizzical blog? Because I was wondering if we could start off by talking a little bit about that and what that is and how it started.
Sure. So I think, yes, it's not an unreasonable thing to do, because a lot of what I did with Astroquizzical started as a blog where people sent me questions about outer space. And so a lot of these questions were things that I, as a trained scientist, would not have thought of. And some of them were hypotheticals and other things of like, what would happen if you did this, which you can't really do, but I'm curious about it anyways. And so it did get me into kind of the less standard set of facts that you would read about in like an introductory textbook or something like that. But then there are the other thing that got us into the new book is that there are these like floating quotes of things that exist in outer space. So you have like, oh yeah, did you know that in outer space there's this? And so that was kind of the other lead in to what The Milky Way Smells of Rum and Raspberries turned into.
When you get these questions from people, do any of them really stump you? Do any of them make you pause and think, whoa, that's actually really difficult to answer?
Frequently, yes. I would say about 3/4 of the time, I don't know the answer offhand. I can usually find the answer, which is more than the average person would be able to do, because I can go read the technical papers and come back and be like, all right, here's what I needed to Google to get to those things. But there are frequently things where something comes in and I'm just like, oh, that's a good question. I have no idea. But then I continue onwards from there. So it doesn't really stump me permanently. But there's a moment of like, huh, I don't know. So like a really good example of that was someone asked me if you could surf the sun, assuming that you didn't incinerate. So it's like, I'm pretty sure the answer is no, even excluding the incineration problem. But I didn't have a good sense of like, what's the density of the sun versus the density of water? And where do those two match? How far into the sun do you have to be before you match the density of water or the human body? It was quite far in, but I had to go looking in papers to find that information to be able to come back and say like, no, you would sink like a third of the way into the sun before you started to be buoyant.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it must be one of those things that like sort of newcomers to a subject often have those questions that experts like yourself, you know, aren't concentrating on, because you're concentrating on perhaps bigger questions, you know?
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily bigger questions, but just different styles of question. So this kind of question, the information is there. We already know, like people have already published what the sun's density is like from center to edge. But the kinds of questions that people who study the sun are now trying to answer are much more like specific and detailed questions. So this is a perfectly viable question to ask. It's just that it's not the same kind of question that active researchers are going to be doing.
Yeah. And so with your new book, Milky Way Smells of Rum and Raspberries, did you have like was there a big long list that you had to narrow down? And if so, was it difficult to narrow down?
There was a bit of a list. It wound up shaking out to about right, actually. Because there was a list of things that I came up with originally as like, hey, this is the kind of book I'd like to write. These are the sorts of things I could talk about, which was a bit shorter than what we needed in the end. So I did actually have to find some more things to add in. And there were a few more that I found that were like, yeah, I guess I could write about that. But I wound up the ones that I was most keen to write about all went in. So there was a little bit more of like, what else do people think about outer space that I can go find? And like, what other weird facts float around that I could go dig into? So it was more of a building up than a narrowing down. But there's loads. So I mean, if I had kept digging for more things, we could have kept going forever.
Yeah, well, maybe there you go. You know, volume two. let's discuss the title, because that's the one that's drawing everyone into the book. Does the Milky Way indeed smell of rum and raspberries?
Well. Yes, but it's more specific than that. So the Milky Way has a lot of things going on. And very specifically at the center of the Milky Way, there's a big cloud of gas. And in that cloud of gas, people have found a compound that on Earth is responsible for the smell of rum and the flavor of raspberries. And so if you were in the center of the Milky Way, then yes, this compound is there. And so it does have that, it's there in this gas cloud in the center of the Milky Way. It would make for a terrible cocktail, though, which is the joke on the front cover as well, because there's all sorts of other stuff in this gas cloud that will absolutely kill you. so there's all sorts of toxins and other things that are like, there's methane in there, there's methanol in there, there's ethanol, which is grain alcohol, but like, don't drink it. Because there's also some cyanide and other really awful chemicals in there. So you wouldn't want to go there and sniff it. but the compound itself is in fact there. Yeah.
That was one of the things I was going to ask, because it does sound really nice. It sounds like a really nice cocktail, you know, like maybe like some like white rum and you know, raspberry puree or something would be lovely.
Yeah.
But with those chemicals or like the sort of the alcohol specifically, there wouldn't actually be any way of sort of harvesting that or sampling it, would there? Or?
Yeah, it would be tricky. It's much easier to do it from home. The clouds of gas in a galaxy are generally very, very thin. So you could imagine trying to harvest the water out of a cloud. Like, technically, that's possible. But practically speaking, it's much easier to wait for it to rain. But the clouds in the Milky Way are so much less dense than air that it's really like trying to harvest water out of something that's even thinner than air, where it's like, that's a lot of work at this point. Like, technically it's probably possible, but practically speaking, just brew it at home. it's going to be much faster if you just don't bother with this like harvesting process, because you'd have to condense it down by an absurd degree before you had any kind of liquid.
The other thing that's really strikes you about the book is that it's not just cool facts. It's also, you also go into the reasons why these facts are known and how it benefits, because obviously, you know, that's a cool thing to know, that the Milky Way smells of rum and raspberries, but how does that knowledge actually, does that knowledge actually have any meaningful purpose within sort of scientific pursuit?
Yeah, so the ultimate science goal of this particular set of, like, we're looking at this gas cloud in the center of the Milky Way, we're looking for eventually is amino acids, which are the building blocks of life on Earth. And so before you're going to find, but they're quite a complex molecule, and so their signature is going to be pretty complex as well. And so before you're going to be able to find those, you're going to find all these other chemicals and identify like, okay, this bit of what we're seeing is because of ethanol, and this bit is because of some form of cyanide, and this bit is, so you kind of have to have this list of what you know is there before you're going to be able to find this relatively complex molecule that you're looking for. And the goal of looking for amino acids is to see how common they are. because if amino acids are common in the galaxy, then life might be more common than it otherwise would be if amino acids are rare. So that's the end goal of this one, is to try and figure out, like, how frequently do you see these complex molecules that led to life on Earth? And if they're frequent and common, then they're probably on other planets somewhere else in the galaxy. And so we might have things like bacteria or other weird forms of life somewhere else in the galaxy, if it's common. So
awesome.
It's a big question, but it comes out with this accidental, like, oh, it smells like rum in there.
Yeah. But obviously the other point about that is that you wouldn't actually be able to smell it. So I think it's really interesting that, I should just clarify that is correct, isn't it? You know, if you were able to somehow float in space, would you be able to smell that?
I'm guessing there would be not enough of it to smell. Yeah. I'm not sure. That's a biology question, and that's outside my wheelhouse. I don't know what the nasal response is to, like, how much of a chemical you need. And I think I know that it's different for different molecules. So, like, the reason that skunk smell is so bad is because the human nose is really sensitive to it. So I don't know whether we would be able to smell it at those concentrations. My guess is that because it's so much less dense than air, the answer would be no.
Yeah, because I think the reason I assumed that you wouldn't be able to smell it was because there's another chapter which is the moon smells of gunpowder, and that was that came from the Apollo missions, didn't it? And you were saying that they didn't smell it until they got back on board and took off their helmets.
So the reason they didn't smell it before then is because their helmets are like airtight sealed to them. And they couldn't smell it before they got out because their capsule was also airtight sealed. And so what happened was that they would put their suits on, seal themselves in so they didn't leak any air, go outside, get absolutely covered in moon dust, and then come back in, seal everything down again, and then take off their helmets. But now they're covered in dust. And so now they've got dust floating in the air that they've now sealed in with themselves. And so that's where they start to smell, like, oh, it smells like gunpowder in here. And they have to wait for the air circulation system to clear it before it stops smelling of gunpowder.
I think it's a really interesting point, that, because I think if I were an astronaut and that happened to me, I'm not sure that I knew what gunpowder smells like. So, but they happened to know what gunpowder smelled like, so they were able to use that as a reference.
These are all ex-military, almost exclusively. they're like Air Force pilots and things like that. So they would have smelled it, yes.
Yeah. Because I think there was like, Tim Peake was asked, what does space smell like? And he said, after a spacewalk, you get a smell like burnt toast. I think it's really interesting that you sort of like relate these things to everyday life. It's sort of it's quite a cool reference point.
Yeah, it is. It's a neat one. It was fun going through the Apollo logs, because that's where I got the stuff about the gunpowder smell. And you can hear the astronauts are also kind of like, huh, yeah, it really does smell like gunpowder. Like, they'd been warned after the first mission that, like, it's going to smell like gunpowder, but they're still kind of surprised by it. Like, oh yeah, it does smell like gunpowder.
One of the other chapters that was really interesting was when galaxies collide, the individual stars don't collide, and I was really interested to hear your thoughts on that particular chapter, because isn't that sort of your speciality in terms of your own research?
Yes, it is. This is a thing that I study. It's the collisions between galaxies and how those go forward and what we can learn from them. So yeah, that one was close to my science heart.
Yeah, because I suppose that's what I meant whenever I was sort of saying that, you know, astrophysicists like yourself focus on the big questions. So like, you're asking, you know, how do galaxy collisions affect the evolution of galaxies? Whereas people like myself will ask, can you surf on the sun?
But even this one, like, do stars collide when you throw two galaxies together? It's like, in my context, we just assume that the answer is no, right? Because we've had this explanation given to us once early on in our careers, and we went, yeah, makes sense, and we carried on. Whereas this particular one, it's like, really, let's sit down and work out why that doesn't work. Why do no stars ever collide? It's like, oh, because we have to think about how much of a galaxy is just nothing. like stars relative to the spaces between stars are tiny. And so working through that math of saying, oh, well, okay, here's the size of a galaxy and here's how many stars are in there and here's how tiny the stars are. And so are they likely to hit anything? No. Given that as a homework problem to my students of working this out.
Oh, that's cruel.
They're upper level astrophysics students. They can handle it. They've got the material.
So what does happen when galaxies collide? How much do we know happens when galaxies collide?
We've got quite a good understanding at this point because we have the combination of seeing lots of galaxies that are in the process of a collision. We don't actually get to see real galaxies go through the whole process because it takes several billion years, and I do not have that kind of time. But we also have simulations, so computer models that we can run where we put in, like, okay, here's a galaxy, it's made of these things, and like here's the physics that we think is important, and run it. And so then you can take, you know, 2 weeks or something to run these simulations, and then you've sped it up by a lot, and then you can watch what happens. And you can then compare those results with what we can see with galaxies that are in the real universe in the process. And so then you can figure out, like, oh, well, is this physics enough, or do we need more, or do we need less, or is this okay? Is this good enough for our purposes now? So we can actually pick out quite a lot, even though we can't watch it happen in the real universe in real time. So no stars collide, but when you have two massive objects next to each other, they pull on each other and kind of stretch each other out, which is very similar to the way that the moon pulls on Earth's water and we get the tides. Except that water is a lot more dense than galaxies. The galaxies can wind up very pulled in a way that the water on Earth's oceans is not. And so you could really stretch out a galaxy into an interesting shape just by having the gravitation, the mass of the other galaxy nearby. And so you get these really dramatic shapes. And if you have the two galaxies going through each other, then the stars don't hit, but the gas does. So galaxies, we think, are largely made out of stars, gas, and dust. And the dust and gas usually go together. And gas does hit itself, which is how sound waves go. So you can basically hit gas against other gas, and that makes a pressure wave, or can make a pressure wave. And so then if you smush two piles of gas together and make it denser, you can start forming stars. And so inside these galaxies that are in the process of colliding with each other, you tend to see lots of new stars forming, which is going to be because the gas is doing something it doesn't normally have to do. And which in some cases is hitting directly, and in other cases it's just the jostling from being stretched out. So you get really fantastic shapes, lots of new stars. The galaxies go very blue, and it can be an interesting thing to study. I've sometimes called it the Etch-a-Sketch model of, like, what happens when you shake a galaxy? Like, well, let's see what happens when we shake this thing.
And isn't it the case that that's going to happen to the Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxy?
Yes, it is. So I have often asked, there's two portmanteaus for what we should call the resulting galaxy. There's Andromeda or Milkdromeda. And I don't like either of these names. But yes, in about 3 or 4 billion years, the Milky Way and Andromeda are predicted to merge into a single galaxy.
So I guess, you know, sort of studying mergers that are happening now is a sort of a good way of working out what will happen to our galaxy in the future?
That's one application of it, yeah. It's trying to figure out, well, okay, we have this kind of galaxy and this kind of galaxy, and if we throw them together, what should it look like? People are still publishing papers on what the Milky Way and Andromeda collision end product will be. It's like, will it build another disk galaxy? Will it look kind of like a spiral as we've currently got? Or is it going to scramble the whole two galaxies entirely and make a big red round fuzzball?
Cool.
Either option is still on the table.
What about this other one that really caught my eye was our galaxy is flatter than a credit card.
Yeah. Now, it is extremely flat.
There's some little mass in there that I had to follow.
Yeah, I couldn't think of any other way to get through that one, though. Yeah. But I tried to pull in with as many analogies to other flat things as possible. So, the Milky Way is extraordinarily flat. And so almost all the stars are in a very, very thin disk, which is what we see edge on in the sky if you're in a place dark enough to see the Milky Way. And so that's why it's such a narrow band across the sky, is because the stars in our galaxy are almost all in that one particular place, in that one particular range. And so then if you want to figure out, like, okay, well, that's pretty narrow. Even by eye, we can see that's quite narrow. And then how big is it from edge to edge? And that ratio gives you a sense of flatness. And so I was then trying to figure out, like, okay, what else can we use as a comparison? So how big is it from edge to edge is kind of a fuzzy number. We don't know that number very well. So there's a little bit of a range. But we could do things like, okay, well, how does it compare to a sheet cake? Like, well, you need a really large sheet cake before that starts to become similar. Or how much does it compare to the size of a typical pizza? Again, you need an American-sized pizza before that starts to become sensible. But credit cards are about the right size. So if you stick two of them lengthwise together, that is about the ratio. So if the twice the long way of a credit card times that thickness, that's about the ratio of the Milky Way.
So cool. I mean, because it's obviously really, presumably really, really difficult to work out the size and shape of our own Milky Way when we're so small and we're in it.
We are in it. That is the biggest problem with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're trying to measure a thing that is fundamentally very diffuse. And we would like to know where it stops while we're also inside it, and we cannot have an external perspective on it. It's quite a tricky thing.
Yeah, absolutely. The other topic that sort of crops up quite a lot in the book is black holes. I think there's like maybe two or three facts on black holes. And I sort of thought, you know, it's quite in vogue at the moment, really, you know, given those sort of two Event Horizon Telescope images that have come out over the past few years. I mean, I assume black holes were just something that were black holes something that you sort of felt there's just so many strange things going on here.
I mean, black holes are fundamentally very odd. Yeah. So, having some things in there about black holes did make sense. Some of them were more entertaining for me to write about than others. Just like, I like them all, but there's occasionally ones where I'm like, oh, I can make a really entertaining joke here, and I don't know whether anyone else is going to find it as funny as I do, but I'm amused. So,
no, I definitely chuckled quite a few times.
It's the problem with writing jokes in science. You're just like, am I funny to me or am I funny to other people? Don't know until other people read it.
But I thought it was really interesting because, like, you know, you with black holes, you do sort of hear the same questions like, you know, what would happen if you got sucked into a black hole? So I found it really interesting that there's one of the facts was that there's a black hole that sort of sings a really, really low B flat.
Yes. Yeah. So the interesting things with black holes, you do get kind of the same questions, and they're kind of the fundamental, like, oh, what happens? Like, what happens if you throw something in it? Or what happens if you fell in it? Or why don't we all fall into them? But there are some exceptionally strange other things going on with black holes, and the super low B flat is one of them. And so this is the idea that there's a galaxy in the center of a cluster of galaxies. So clusters hold thousands to tens of thousands of galaxies. And in between the galaxies and clusters, you have, again, very, very thin gas. It's usually really hot, to the point where it glows in the X-ray. So this is a very, very warm gas. And if you have a black hole, you can create a pressure wave inside that gas. So you can basically pulse into the gas, which then creates high pressure, low pressure, high pressure, low pressure. And that is fundamentally a sound wave. Because all sound waves are pressure, and it just goes from high to low to high to low. And how quickly it goes from high to low, it tells you the pitch and the tone. So if you have a very specific frequency, it tells you what note it is. And so you have to, and if you don't have those exact notes, you fall in the cracks in the keyboard and it sounds bad. But this one in particular managed to hit exactly a B flat. It's way off the end of the keyboard, but it is a note. And the cycle time is really long, but it is exactly a B flat with this pressure of up and down cadencing from this black hole.
Yeah, and that's also like a really interesting point you make in the book, is that like, you know, the 11 notes that exist, you know, on a piano keyboard, you know, the naturals and the sharps and the flats.
Yes.
There are sort of quarter tones in between those, but this wasn't like a quarter tone below or above a B flat. It was an actual B flat.
Yeah, I mean, in as far as we can measure it, it is an actual note. It might be slightly out, but like, we can't measure it to that level of precision, especially when the time scale is so long. So yeah, but it, from all accounts at the moment, seems to be an actual B flat.
So do you think that, you know, given the vastness of the universe and the amount of black holes that must exist in the universe, that there would be enough to actually gather,
make a keyboard out of them? There's probably no reason why not. If you like, you have to have enough universe, but we do, so it should be, that should be achievable. Whether or not you can, we're actually going to be able to find them all is a different question entirely, but it should be there. Yeah
That's what I was thinking. Like, is it like a, you know, monkeys and typewriters typing at Shakespeare?
A bit, yeah.
Enough to do like a Beethoven symphony, for example?
Well, you only need 11 notes, right? So yeah. There's a couple that we know of already where you have a sound wave coming from the black hole. I think one of them is not a note, but I think it should be. I mean, it would be a very, very low rendition of Beethoven. It would not be something that the human ear could hear, but we could probably identify enough black holes doing this kind of thing where we could say, all right, that one, then that one, and then that one, to get it to assemble that way. Yeah
So a lot of the book is focused on the sort of, you know, the vastness of the cosmos and black holes and galaxies, but there are quite a few cool facts closer to home. One of the ones that I was really thinking about was this, the idea of growing turnips on Mars, or indeed growing anything on Mars, because it pertains to this idea that we have as a species at the moment of eventually establishing a colony on Mars, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is going to be a problem with living on Mars in the future, is that Mars dirt is poison to living things. And if you manage to grow something in the Mars dirt without removing the poison, then you make poison plants, which then kills your human. So not ideal as a process at the moment. That was actually one of the things I spent a lot of time doing research on, because I was not aware of that particular problem on Mars. I knew about a lot of the issues on Mars of like, the atmosphere there is very thin, and so you get a lot of UV radiation, and UV radiation gives you skin cancer and generally bad. And the soil is a little bit, isn't neutral, it's a little bit basic. And so basic contents on your skin is usually also not a good idea. But the idea that the soil actually has toxins to humans in it was new to me when I was reading. And so this was really fascinating for me to go through and figure out, like, oh, that is a problem. And because this particular thing that's in the soil, perchlorate, will ruin your thyroid. And the thyroid is required for functioning metabolism. And so that is not a thing that humans can do without.
How do you sort of feel about the notion that we would travel to Mars and establish a colony, because the more you learn about everything about Mars, it just seems so inhospitable that you think, will it ever even be possible to build any type of sort of comfortable society there?
I mean, I think it will be possible to have humans live on Mars temporarily, in the way that we've sent humans to the moon for several days, right? That, I think, is achievable. The problem with the Mars rather than the moon, it takes about 3 days to get to the moon. It takes about 3 years to get to Mars. So there's a whole bunch of technological problems you have to achieve solutions to before you even get to Mars. And then once you get there, it's awful, right? So there are things that we could learn about Mars that would be much faster achieved with a human there. Like if you send a geologist to Mars, we'll be able to go pick up interesting rocks much faster than sending a robot there. That said, robots don't care about poison soil and the UV radiation. So it's a lot safer on a human perspective to have uncrewed missions that we send over and learn from those. In terms of having like a long-term colony there or a long-term habitation of any type, there's some interesting issues with the like language of colonization that happens with Mars as well. And so like having any kind of human habitation on Mars for long-term, I don't know how soon that's going to be practical. I think as we continue to develop spacefaring technologies, it will become more achievable. It's not impossible to remove the poison from the soil, but you definitely have to do it. And I don't think we have practice removing this toxin from dirt at this high of a level. So there's going to be a lot of challenges. And we're going to have to try our best not to be awful about who we send and under what conditions we send them, which is a whole other ethical tangle.
Yeah, because I guess probably the most difficult part of going to Mars is getting back, I suppose.
Well, going and coming back have kind of the similar challenges.
Yeah.
It takes a really long time. But the bigger issue, I think, in many cases is that, I mean, Mars is bad for your health. And so if you start having major health issues, you're either going to have to be able to deal with them on Mars or wait 3 years to return.
Yeah.
Which is not usually ideal if you're having major health issues. And like if you need chemotherapy or any kind of cancer treatments for after having been exposed to the Martian radiation levels for a while, it's like you probably don't want to wait 3 years to start those treatments. And so then do you have those facilities on Mars? Well, that's pretty advanced medical needs that you're then having to establish alongside your habitation.
Yeah, absolutely. A little bit sort of nearer in time in the future got me thinking about these sort of upcoming robotic missions to the Jovian system, sort of Jupiter and its moons. Juice and the Europa Clipper.
Yes.
With regard to the chapter that you have on whether or not Europa is glow in the dark. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. I hope it's true. Right now, it's like it's a possibility. It could glow in the dark. We've looked, and so far we haven't seen anything really bright. It doesn't mean it's not there. It could just be that it's not very bright. But yeah, as we are planning to go to Europa, like the Europa Clipper mission, we should be able to check. And I really do hope that it does glow in the dark, because that's just fun. Just like, oh yeah, just ice, and then you throw it into near Jupiter and it should just glow. Like, that's cool. I hope it does.
Is it related to any processes that we would know on Earth? Like, you know, is it similar to the glow in the dark stars we all had on our ceilings and when we were kids?
So I actually had to go through all the different kinds of glow in the darkness. So glow in the dark stars are a form of glow in the dark where it absorbs light during the daytime, and then it glows for a time afterwards when you remove, and I mean it glows during the daytime too, you just don't see it because it's bright. So this is a really specific kind of glow. So you have to have really high energy stuff hitting ice. And so Jupiter, being really nearby, has this absurdly strong magnetic field. And that magnetic field is able to make things go extremely high speed and just produces a lot of this radiation generally. And so then you can have all of that around already and just slam it into the surface and it should glow in the optical range. Like, this should be something that the human eye could see if there was enough of it. But yeah, this one was fun because I also got to learn about fluorescence, which is when you shine a light on something in one wavelength and it comes out at another wavelength. So like anything that glows under a black light is fluorescent. So it's absorbing the UV, which is the black light, and then glows in the invisible. So, but as soon as you turn the black light off, it stops. So that's the distinction there. Fun fact about fluorescence is that all scorpions fluoresce.
Oh, cool.
I don't know why, but if you talk to anyone who is a geologist or does field work in the desert, they have UV black lights to carry with them to check for scorpions.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, it's really neat. It's all of them as well. It's like, why? Nobody knows.
That's a really cool fact.
You can check for scorpions with a black light.
We're sort of approaching the end of our time on the podcast here. So I did want to finish off with just sort of, because it sort of got me thinking about all the different weird facts left to sort of discover. And I was sort of thinking that in relation to things like, you know, the Webb Space Telescope having just launched, and then we've got things like the Square Kilometer Array organization, you know, due to go online. And it does sort of feel like we're on the precipice of a sort of a new era in astrophysics and cosmology. I was just wanting to get your thoughts on that, and sort of the future and what it might hold for you and your colleagues.
I think one of the fun things about astronomy is that there is always this kind of sense of like, oh man, we're going to get to learn so much new stuff. Because JWST launched, and JWST is going to be transformative, I think, in terms of the things that we will be able to observe that we have not been able to see before. And so that telescope is going to give us all kinds of interesting things about other planets and other systems and galaxies that are really far away, and all kinds of cool things will come out of that. But we're always building new instruments, and there are new missions all the time. So you mentioned Europa Clipper. We've got new missions planned to go to Venus soon-ish. we've got things, if there's always something. So depending on what you're interested in learning about, there is often this sense of like, oh, stuff is coming. And because the universe is so big and so filled with unexpected and strange things, we will continue to learn more and more about this. Like, oh, there are weird things out there. And we can just keep going and keep learning, which is, I think, one of the benefits of being in astronomy myself, is that I do get to keep that sense of like, oh boy, new things. Just even as a professional, it's like, oh, this is neat. I've learned something new today.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Because it's cool. You know, it's fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I do it. Sometimes people ask, like, oh, why do you do astronomy? Like, it's neat. I like it. I like knowing things about outer space. It's just fun.
Cool. Thanks for speaking to me today, Gillian. That's about all the time we have. Good luck with the book when it comes out.
Thank you. Thanks for having
me. We'll, you know, maybe in another few years, we'll speak again and discuss some of the cool stuff that these new missions and telescopes have discovered.
Yeah, hopefully so.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to Acast, iTunes, or Spotify.